Welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast number 415. I'm Tom Cagley, your host, and in today's Software Process and Measurement Cast, we have four columns. We begin with our essay on recognizing risk and risk tolerance. Any discussion of risk begins with acknowledging that risk exists and then recognizes specific risks. Once we know risks exist, we need to determine which risks we care about. Risk tolerance affects how everyone in an organization behaves. Kim Preece, the software sensei, discusses change models, focusing on the Cotter model of change. Kim discusses how change models can be used for hardware, software, processes, and procedures. Gene Hewson brings his wonderful Form Follows Function blog to the podcast. In this installment, Gene and I discussed organizations as systems. Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. We talked a lot about how to define innovation and why innovation and change is powerful. John Quigley anchors the cast with the third installment of a three-part arc on requirements in his Alpha Omega of Product Development column. This week, John discusses managing requirements. Risk Tolerance in Agile Efforts, Thomas M. Cagley Jr., Megan E. Cagley. A risk is the potential or exposure to danger, harm, or loss. The concept of risk is understandable to everyone involved in delivering work, at least at a basic level. We understand that stuff can happen when we least expect it to happen, in a project or in our individual lives. The question is whether any specific risk or accumulation of risks is worth taking action to avoid. Which risks are perceived to be so daunting that they need to be actively avoided is based on personal and organizational perspectives and biases. The technical term for this behavior is risk tolerance. In response to one of my blog's posts, Matt Williams commented, "An important step that I think often gets overlooked is the act of defining a risk tolerance. While many teams or organizations may have an intuitive sense of their risk tolerance, I think it's helpful to have an explicit, conscious discussion about risk tolerance. We can define risk tolerance in simple terms as how much value we're willing to lose if a risk materializes, becomes an issue. The impact of a risk materializing and becoming an issue can range from rework, a reduction in returns, shifting positive perceptions, or a compliance failure. A reflection of risk tolerance in many financial markets is often the difference between the rate of return for a financial instrument, stocks, bonds, and others, and another financial instrument, such as a treasury bond. In finance, the higher the risk, the higher the return is required to balance that risk. If risk tolerance is important for the governance of software development and maintenance projects, we need a mechanism to define tolerable and intolerable risks before we can decide to roam those risks. Assessing risk tolerance is an evaluation of the willingness to take on risks and how much exposure from threats from outside the company are acceptable. In a further comment, Mr. Williams went on, "I think risk tolerance is very context specific. It depends in part on the organization, its size, culture, mission, etc. In part on the project and its specific nature, and in part on the nature of the risk itself. Every person and organization have different levels of risk tolerance. We can visualize risk tolerance in a chart as a curve. Risk tolerance is a balance between the probability a risk occurs and the impact that will be realized if it does occur. In most software development and maintenance efforts, defining the risk tolerance curve is an implicit rather than an explicit act. The issue is that a team's or organization's level of risk tolerance will cause different behaviors. Risk avoiders teams or organizations that fear the impact of risk will tend to do more research and analysis before committing on a direction. Risk takers tend to try approaches and then pivot if needed. Knowing and being able to predict a team's risk tolerance is important. For example, a few years ago, I was asked to assess a team that had operated like clockwork for several years, delivering superb value and quality of work. However, recently their quality had been questionable. Their clients were finding significant defects in production. There had been no significant personnel changes, nor was the type of work that they were doing significantly different. In the end, we determined that someone up the hierarchy had decided to remove quality from the team's objectives. Therefore, how raises and promotions would be assessed, and double down on making dates and meeting budgets. Change had the unintended consequence of changing the team's risk tolerance curve. On the surface, at least, taking chances that might impact quality became less risky to the team, therefore more easy to change. Two relatively simple ways to approach a discussion of risk tolerance are, one, every team and project has an implicit risk tolerance curve. Some risks are acceptable and some are not. Shifting a team or organization's risk tolerance from implicit to explicit requires explicit discussion. In the project environment, the simplest approach is to hold an explicit discussion of risk. Specifically, ask participants to achieve consensus on whether examples of risk should be accepted or not. It is powerful for examples to be risks that have been recognized by the team and organization in the past, peppered with a few examples that are possible but more external to the team. The discussion will tend to touch on probability and potential impact and will expose the participants' perception of the risk. The team must end by agreeing on whether the team would accept or not accept the risk. By the way, accept can include taking on mitigation tasks. While an explicit risk tolerance curve is not generated, the team will develop a clearer understanding of which risks it will tolerate and which it will not. The examples also provide a set of analogies that can be used to assess risks as they're recognized. A handy set of analogies is extremely useful for every team member. Using analogies is a form of pattern recognition, which is a cognitive bias. Two, a more quantitative approach to quantify risk uses an approach popularized by Michael Land, or any other quantitative scheme can be used, which assesses each risk based on impact and probability to determine just how risky the risk is. Land's model equates a low impact, low probability to a 1. And the highest probability, highest impact to 25. Based on the quantification, the team can quickly develop a consensus that any combination of impact and risk above a certain number can't be accepted by the team. In essence, the team says that up to a certain point, they can mitigate or deal with a potential risk, but after that, someone outside the team needs to own or indemnify the team from the potential that the risk turns into an issue, or they can't go forward. The quantification provides a proxy for the line in the risk tolerance curve, and the rated risk can be used as a set of analogies for the team members to do a real-time triage of newly discovered risks. Both of these approaches represent a mechanism to have an explicit and structured discussion of risk tolerance. Both approaches have an advantage over less structured approaches because they generate group knowledge and memory and artifacts that can be used to aid the team using the team's consensus as a tool to reinforce the memory. At a recent Q&A session, I was asked, where could a person get their project risks? I stifled a smart alecky answer that would have included driving to the grocery store and decided that the question that was really being asked was that was being asked was really, how do I go about recognizing and capturing risks? Perhaps a more boring question, but far more important. If I answered the first question, the answer would have been that risks are generated by the interaction of the project with other projects, applications, and business, technology, and world. Those are risk categories. Pretty much the existence of a project could be considered a risk magnet. The answer to the second question is that once you have a risk magnet, you will need to ask as many different people as is feasible to recognize the possible risk. The discussion of risk is always appropriate. However, the typical meeting and events and types of people to consider in the conversation needs to be planned. The discovery process typically follows the requirements user stories discovery process outlined below. Start by carving out time when you are developing the backlog and ask as diverse a group as possible to identify the potential problems that could get in the way of delivering the value promised by the project. Prompt the group to consider business, technical, operational, and organizational factors. Diversity is incredibly important to inject different perspectives so that the team does not fall prey to only seeing the risks they expect, a form of cognitive bias. Form a small team. Consider the three amigos to interview stakeholders that are not part of the planning process. Explain the project and use the same category prompts to generate a risk discussion. Gather the risk data through surveys when the program stakeholders are geographically diverse. Note, I only seen this used well in large programs with professional market research staffs. Interview customers or potential customers. Customer interviews are not generally used as a standalone risk discovery tool, but rather as a tool to gather requirements, user stories. However, piggybacking a few questions to solicit potential risks is useful to add diversity of thought to risk identification. Finally, periodically ask about risks, either as an agenda item or as a follow-on to the standard meetings. For example, I've seen teams that have successfully added a five-minute follow-on to their daily stand-up once a week in order to consider risks. A quick risk recognition session can easily be added to the other standard meetings many projects have. Other standard Scrum meetings that can be used to identify risks include demonstrations, retrospectives, and sprint planning. Each of these meetings will provide a different perspective on the project and team, therefore could expose other potential risks. The baseline answer to the question of how I can recognize and capture risks is by involving all of the project stakeholders in a discussion of potential risks. The process of collaboration and discussion will help increase the diversity of thought, reducing the number of potential unknowns, unknowns that could impact the project's ability to deliver value. Any discussion of risks begins with acknowledging that risks exist and then recognizing specific risks. Once we know risk exists, we need to determine which risks we care about. Risk tolerance affects how everyone in an organization behaves. Rarely, however, does everyone in an organization have the same tolerance toward risk. Defining, or at least developing, an understanding of a team's risk tolerance isn't merely an academic discussion. Differences in risk tolerance can generate tensions and risks of its own. Therefore, at the very least, teams need, in the words of Mr. Williams, to have an explicit, conscious discussion. Thoughts, comments, all welcome. Feel free to reach out to us at spamcastinfo@gmail.com. Leave a message at the United States number 1-440-668-5717. We look forward to the conversation.
This is your software sensei, Kim Price. Let's look at a change model. Perhaps one of the most famous is that of John Cotter, which contains the following sections: create urgency, form a powerful coalition, create a vision for change, communicate the vision, empower action, create quick wins, build on the change, and make it stick. The primary weakness of models such as this lies in the imprecision of most of the vocabulary. Hence, in order to make such a model work, we have to take the qualitative and transform each heading into quantitative goals. I'm not foolish enough to denigrate the qualitative. After all, that is primarily how we really live our lives. In order to make such statements actionable, we have to put numbers to them, and I don't mean the numbers in the heading, of course. My Six Sigma experience makes number 6, create quick wins, stand out, since quick wins are a good way to demonstrate the validity of the project approach, the savings, and at little risk. Notice, however, some of the other phrases are truly difficult to enable, and we'll take a look at those one by one. So let's start with create urgency. If we don't already have urgency, how do we create urgency? Somehow I don't think Cotter was referring to punitive approaches. I've read nearly all of his books, and nowhere does he mention punishment. In some cases, the very nature of the situation will produce urgency. For example, a product recall or emergency update pushed out to users. If we form a powerful coalition, his second step, we can make progress. I cannot disagree with forming a powerful coalition. Forming coalitions will generally require extremely good negotiating skills as well as substantial tact. It is at this second stage that we make or break our initiative. No boss support unlikely to occur. We could create a vision for change, the third step. Vision provides something for people to metaphorically grab onto. Generating a compelling vision is not easy, or we wouldn't need to speak about it. And vision is often confused with mission. Mission is what we do. Vision is where we are going. We derive our goals and tasking from the gap between the two. And the simpler the vision statement, the more powerful the words are. Think about it. Next is communicate the vision. Well, communicating the vision makes sense once we have a usable vision statement. And perhaps we can improve the vision statement as we go along by running experiments. We don't want to take too long because too many vision statements, we're going to confuse a lot of people. We can use multiple channels to communicate this vision, and we should solicit feedback from our teams to ensure the vision is comprehensible. Next, we would empower action. Empowering action is easy to say. Employees often interpret the word empowerment to be tantamount to shifting blame to the empowered individual. If we are in a major software development initiative, for example, something like instantiating DevOps, then management must provide the individuals on the teams with the ability to implement as needed, presumably with appropriate reviews and so forth, but by no means act like truly hardcore gatekeepers and stopping the initiative. Presumably, we're doing the change because we need to do the change. Creating quick wins. As I noted earlier, the quick wins help drive the rest of the change initiative. If the quick wins also provide for improved revenue or margin, we have cause for a reinforcing celebration. Build on the change. When we build on the change, we are taking those quick wins and pushing into more difficult projects. These projects must be decomposed sufficiently that we can still measure and maintain the momentum of our change effort. In other words, we make the big projects look a lot like quick wins. Finally, we have make it stick, and this is about sustainability. I once eliminated the habit of using a special designator for printed circuit boards at an electronics firm. The staff would use these designators during development and then switch to Rev A for release. This is not unheard of in software development, and this was hardware development. This approach was not deadly in itself. but it did obscure weaknesses on the design side as the engineers would flail their way through multiple versions. Not all engineers, the company wasn't terrible, none of the above. It's just some engineers seemed to have the inability to model their product sufficiently that the first two or three tries were sufficient to move on to a product release. The moment I no longer had management control over these individuals, they went right back to the covering up of flailing. Hence, the change was not sustainable. Sustainability can be the most difficult part of the change process, since existing employees are generally comfortable with the way they are and were doing things, or they would have changed them already. All of the comments I have made today apply to software, hardware, procedures, processes, and people. Also, Cotter might have added a check at the beginning to see if the change is really necessary. I think most of us have survived corporate reorganizations that look like change, but really reflected shifts in power and influence. Until next time, this is your software sensei, Kim Price.
Gene Houston, welcome back to the Software Process and Measurement Cast. Gene, your wonderful Form Follows Function blog, I get a ton out of it. Today, can we tackle all aboard the innovation bandwagon?
Oh, absolutely, Tom. And thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure, sir. By the way, I really like the picture in there. It is a bandwagon. Where's the picture from? Where did you get that one?
I picked that one up off of Wikipedia. Confession time, I actually recycled it. I used this on a microservice post year, maybe 2 years ago. Similar theme about jumping on a bandwagon. So it was such a perfect example that I had to use it again.
Well, there you go. So it is fun. Well, I'm going to go back and see if I can remember which one that was, because I didn't remember the picture. But then again, you know, sometimes things falling out of your memory is a positive, so that you can be surprised and ecstatic about something like a picture again. Gene, everybody's an innovator today, obviously, right? Everybody's on the bandwagon. Everybody must be an innovator. True or false?
Everybody wants to be an innovator. I think what's a smaller group is everybody understanding what that means and understanding what's involved in doing that. I'm reminded of an old cartoon where an elf is sitting here looking up at Santa Claus, and Santa Claus is yelling, going, "How should I know what it is? Just build it." And innovation is falling into that these days, because there's a lot of people who are not necessarily understanding what that means for their particular market segment, but they're being told, this is what we've got to do. We've got to be innovative. We've got to be digital. Not understanding what does that mean? How do we get to there, et cetera. And it's one of those things where I made the point in the post that it means, part of being innovative means understanding your strategy, not just following the latest thing. And I used Kodak as an example based on, it was inspired by a post from Casimir Artman, where he talked about Kodak's failures in the digital photography space. And much of that came from Kodak looking at things not from their customer's viewpoint, but from their own internal viewpoint. And so even though they had a lot of technological advantages that would have enabled a lot of innovation, for example, they actually invented digital photography back in 1975. But after doing so, they realized that, hey, this would really kill our film business. So So yeah, we don't want to do this. And truly, it did wind up killing their film business. But by sitting on it rather than developing it, it also allowed somebody else to kill their film. So the film business died either way, but they lost out on a huge head start that they could have had to be the one to reap the benefits of it.
Yeah, there's very little left of Kodak at this point. Innovation, I think, is a lot of it is a buzzword, and it's about getting organizations and products buzzword compliant. Without a customer, without truly extending or doing something different, that's not really innovation. I mean, it might be interesting thought games, but if you don't move, if you don't move the ball forward, how can it be innovation?
Absolutely. And to make this really topical, we have the recent Apple announcements around the iPhone 7. And, you know, there's a lot of digital ink being spilled over that. And I've been following that and kind of weighing in mind if I have anything additional to say. But just kind of a short thought that comes to mind from all that right off the top is I see where Apple did away with some things. I'm not sure I see where they added. So that makes me wonder. They asked them, you know, why'd you get rid of the headphone jack? And the answer was courage. Courage can be good, courage can be bad. And I have to wonder if people are going to see enough value, because again, use Scott Berkin's wonderful definition of innovation. It's significant positive change. I certainly could be wrong, but I'm not sure I see significant positive change in their
iPhone. Well, especially from the customer point of view. I mean, there's so many different innovations, and some things are very innovative. We Uber brought an innovative business model, at least to the taxi world. Others that have followed have built on that. I don't necessarily see that as innovation. It might be positive. Some of it might be significant positive value, but it doesn't necessarily make it innovative. We tend to follow patterns. Somebody makes the big leap. The iPhone was a big leap. The smartphone has evolved. It continues to change, whether it has a headphone jack or not, you know, whether that makes it more waterproof or not. You know, all interesting things, but where's that next big innovative jump kind of thing? Are there other forms of innovation that we should be thinking about? Is it something big? Is it something small? How do you recommend thinking through this process?
To start with the, is it big, is it small? Yes. yeah, sometimes there are opportunities for something just really, and sometimes it's small incremental changes that drive things forward. And a kind of a good example that I think covers a lot of bases is BlackBerry, Research in Motion. When they came out with the BlackBerry, that, in my opinion, was a huge big bang innovation. It was something that was really positive, really significant, and they were first out of the chute. And unfortunately, they didn't keep going. And consequently, other people who, rather than originating that area of innovation, but who followed RIM into that area, were able to leapfrog to the top of the line. It's, and you'll appreciate this being a runner, it's not how you start the race so much as how you finish. And, you know, with business, it's a marathon. When you finish, that means either the market no longer exists or your company no longer. So it's not a one and done, it's a long-term slog and can't sit back and rest on your laurels.
Is this a recipe? I would suggest that there's a lot of innovation that can be learned. You know, there are things that serial innovators like Phil McKinney suggest that you do that can hone your innovation, quote, as he puts it, your innovation muscle. But I don't think any of the real thought leaders would suggest that this is a recipe. All sorts of things that you can shove into your mind, things like reading the Form Follows Function blog, absorbing what's going on around you, thinking about change. But a lot of people want a recipe. How do you address this whole, is it a recipe, you know, and if it is a recipe, what is that recipe sort of approach?
We've been doing this long enough that you already know my answer on this. There is no recipe that, you know, A, B, C, and you got to win. I think there are a number of principles, a number of mindsets, et cetera, that you can get into. There are practices that you can do to make yourself more likely to be able to come up with an innovation. But in terms of, yeah, follow this recipe and it'll come out perfect every time, no. In probably one of the first things that you can do to help yourself become more innovative is to put that idea up on the shelf, far out of the reach of children, to where it's not going to cause you problems. I think it comes down to being aware of what it is you do, where your money comes from. Car manufacturers don't make money making cars. They make money providing transportation solutions to people. And when they drift into that mindset of, oh, we make money by making cars, you run the risk of thinking, if I make X amount of money by making a million cars, I make 2X amount of money by making 2 million cars. And this is why that definition of significant positive change is so important. If you're solving a problem that nobody has or that nobody's willing to pay money to solve, you might come up with something that's technically really wonderful, but is a dog. Betamax is probably a great example of this for those of us back in the Stone Age that remember Betamax. Technically, much better product than VHS. But the marketing, the footwork in terms of lining up content producers, all of that was lacking. So consequently, the better product from one viewpoint, and notably that's more of an inward-looking viewpoint than an outward-looking viewpoint, which is customer-centric. From that inward-looking viewpoint, Betamax is a better product. From the viewpoint of the people who are actually putting money on the counter and buying products, VHS was a better value. So that multivariate nature of innovation makes the idea of a recipe just laughable, because you know there's too many balls in the air for you to be able to step A, step B, step C. It just can't work.
Absolutely, and that whole Betamax VHS discussion is an interesting conundrum, because very frankly, Betamax was, and at least until relatively recently, because they focused on the professional market and thought that that would trickle down, that it was still widely in use by video professionals because it was so much higher quality than VHS. So again, different market, but that market was nowhere near, you know, the size that Sony thought it would be. And it didn't influence the downstream market. So you're absolutely right. They messed that puppy up. Gene, fantastic. One comment that I have to make, I sense that your blog entries are getting a little longer and much richer. Do you get that sense? Is that something that you see going on at the Form Follows Function blog?
Currently, yes. It's funny. I kind of am very much inspiration driven. Mm-hmm. So sometimes things hit at the right moment, and it winds up being a really long post. So some are shorter. It all kind of depends. But it seems like longer has been the norm for the past few of them.
You know, they actually threw the word richer in there too, because very frankly, we talk about these on occasion. We don't get them all. You're more prolific than that. But very frankly, we're only scratching the surface of the amount of information that the Spamcast listeners could get. Once they hear this, they should run over and actually read the entire post, and then perhaps re-listen to the discussion again. And this is actually perfect timing. How would people get in touch with you? How would they continue this conversation?
In addition to the blog at genehewson.wordpress.com, I can be found on Twitter at Gene Hewson, and I'm also on LinkedIn.
Super. And Gene, thank you again for bringing the wonderful Form Follows Function blog. John M. Quigley, back with the alpha and omega of product development. John, we've tackled evoking requirements, got to capture some of them, got to capture them all over a period of time. Pokemon Go reference there. And we have to write them down in some way, shape, or form. And I guess that depends on the risk and complexity and all sorts of factors, and that varies. But once we have them, we've written them down, obviously we got to do something with them. I think takes us to managing requirements. What is that all about, and why do we have to talk about that?
Well, we know that we're not going to get all the requirements up front.
What? Think what? I'm kidding.
Oh my God, heart attack time.
Yeah, I know. But a lot of people think that's what happens, that you keep working on the requirements until you have something that's pretty close to complete or done, like 90% or something. And then you start building your prototype. But that's really not an effective way to develop the product. It's much better to focus on those, like we talked earlier, what's the most important piece. Let's prioritize those. Let's build those. Let's learn something from those. And then we update our requirements according to what we've learned from that interaction with the product. So managing the requirements is that you're the customer, Tom, and I've built something based on those early requirements. You've played with the product and you say, this is too fast, that's too slow, and I was wrong about this altogether. And then I say, okay, so let's go back and open up the requirements documentation and make changes. This is, needs to be quicker, that needs to be slower, and this needs to be added on. Completely new, and that makes this a new instantiation of the requirements that is mapped to the growth of the product.
What do you mean by mapped to the growth of the product?
The prototype that I just handed you is an iteration. Now, I've just updated the requirements, so I'm going to have to build a new iteration of this product to hand you to do the same thing over again. And so the requirements are constantly growing, and then the product follows close behind the requirements.
So how do I manage that? So if that happens, and I shouldn't sound shocked, because even on the smallest project, do you very rarely jump out of the blocks with knowing everything? And I don't even know that even in the smallest project that that's actually the case, let alone building a true product. So if that's true, right? If we know it's going to change, What are some of the things that we have to do to actually manage that? What does that word mean?
Well, at every point that we build a new product or a prototype, we will have frozen the documentation at least for that period of time. It's like this for the scrum, for the sprint. During that sprint, you have an objective and you have a list of product backlog items that have moved into your sprint backlog, and that's fixed for that sprint. So that's sort of what we're talking about here, even in what people call traditionally call waterfall. There's an iteration of the requirements. They are frozen enough to build an iteration of the product, is then tested, played with by the customer, a number of things to learn something about the product. That learning will go into the requirements. Those requirements were the baseline that produced the previous product. Okay. Now that I'm learning something, I'm going to open up the requirements, which means that's a new revision of the requirements. I'm going to make the adjustment to the requirements. And here is the new baseline for the new product or the next issue of the product, issue or iteration of the product.
So you used the word traceable earlier. Traceability in my career has twice gotten me punched in the nose. When you're using the term traceable, how are you using that term? And I'll duck.
I'm using that so that I can say, when I mean traceable, I see the growth of the requirements based on customer input, right? I can trace that back to the customer input. And more importantly, the growth of the product matched to the requirements. So there's a thread. I worked at a Swedish company, and the Swedish company called it the golden thread. The golden thread that connects the customer requirement through the customer need through the requirements all the way to instantiation of the product. And that has a whole bunch of benefits.
Such as?
Well, number one, when you hand somebody a product, you're assuming that you did build something based on the requirements, which you were supposed to, and you can tell somebody sort of definitively about what you believe is in the product or what the product has in it.
You mean having my BA on the team and claiming that that BA is actually a product owner isn't good enough?
It may not be. If that product owner does not have the technical wherewithal to understand every piece that's in that product or every technical aspect that the product represents.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I sort of foreshadowed my feeling on that, in that anytime you have a proxy product owner that's actually part of the development team, it's very hard to take that person really as the ultimate authority on what the business need was.
Yeah, I agree with that, because essentially the business need likely covers a variety of perspective. We're not selling this to one, typically, not a very, very narrow segment of a customer population. Probably building something that has a variety of perspectives in the people who are going to be using it.
As an aside, when you use the term product, is that part of the message that you're trying to send versus a internal IT project that might be creating a report for Billy Bob or Sarah Lou down in accounting?
For me, there's a little difference between those, yes. Some of the things are common, or probably mostly common, but the degree of rigor and the variation in application is probably greater if you're building a product that goes out to the rest of the world. If it's internal to your customer, then the number of people using it, internal to your organization, then the number of people that are using it are narrower, and it's typically one perspective, the company's perspective on the application.
Right. So given those differences in perspective, how does that affect how a team or a team of teams would then manage a set of product requirements?
A lot of that should come out in the evoking and prioritization of the requirements, any conflicts in that. And then if you have multiple teams working on a larger platform, say it's a number of Scrum teams building a larger software application, then managing those requirements is still going to be very critical, because changes to one piece of those requirements, or changes even from the design level, that may impact the other pieces of the design at the overall system. That's why a lot of people think they can make, or people think they can make a small, innocuous change in their part, and they really haven't made a change to the spec in their mind, perhaps. But because they've made this small change, one of the other modules will not work. And we're going to discover that when we go to put all the parts together. And that's where the managing of the requirements and change management becomes a big deal.
That almost sounds like that whole idea of managing requirements and configuration management are related topics.
Yeah, they are. They are. The configuration management is what controls and provides you that traceability forward and backward of the requirements.
But you don't have to do any of that stuff if you're doing Agile, right?
You might have to duck. No, I have heard that before too, and I immediately had an aneurysm. No, that's not true. Now, you might can get away from a heavy-handed approach to these things, but you're still going to need to manage that. That instance we just talked about where there's multiple Scrum teams producing a larger product, if I make a change that I think is fairly benign and we go to assemble our respective pieces into the system and then find out it doesn't work, we're likely to find that it's because I made a certain decision that I thought was innocuous, it really wasn't.
Fair. And I'm going to pierce the barrier a little bit here. We're recording this in July, and this morning, before the sun came up, I was editing a piece by you it's actually the third iteration of your column, back before we named it, actually, that did post on July 31st. And in that, you suggested that, you know, there was a substantial amount of risk that products, projects all have because assumptions aren't stated. Does having traceable requirements, does having requirements managed help us with these unstated assumptions, or at least surfacing these unstated assumptions?
I think it helps with both. It helps with surfacing the unstated assumptions because you have this control mechanism. And if I have an assumption, there's some place where I can go look to see if my assumption is correct, at least within the contents of the requirements.
Excellent. So, John, when we get to managing requirements, what's the essence here? Is it, if you were to wave your magic wand and fix the one thing that you see broken most often in terms of managing requirements, what would that be?
The documentation requirements and the managing those is not a non-value-added task. Many people believe that, I think, or from their actions, that it's more important to just get up and move, hurry up and go, rather than manage these requirements. And what you end up finding out is the requirements change, but they haven't been managed. And then when the parts go together, the system doesn't work, and you spend a lot of time in rework and damage control, and your project is now behind schedule, and people that were supposed to be doing something else are now doing other things on this project to fix this thing that should never have been a problem.
Agreed. And in your estimation, managing requirements doesn't necessarily preclude getting up and going at the same time, does it?
No, it doesn't. Get what you can, prioritize, understand that best that you can, build that as quick as you can, a prototype version of that as quick as you can, give that to your customers as fast as you can, get something from them as best you can, update your requirements, and then do this again.
Again and again.
And again and again. That's right, Tom. Exactly.
But very frankly, the taking a product versus a project view, I think, allows you to think in cycles versus a cycle that terminates instantaneously and has to then get restarted kind of an approach.
Yeah. I think those project management perspective might be what damages this work a lot of times, that whole I need it all here and we need it all there and the thing's got to end by this date, and there's so many things wrong with those that it doesn't have to end by that date. It may end by that date and it may not.
Perhaps we can talk in the next alpha and omega of product development, that sort of that distinction between project and product.
I look forward to it. That'll be a lot of fun.
John, people want to continue this conversation. They want to find out how to punch both of us in the nose for these conversations. How would they go about finding you on the internet?
Well, they can reach me at tkagley. John.quigley at valuetransform.com. John M. Quigley on Twitter. And John M. Quigley on LinkedIn as well. And I look forward to hearing from you.
Absolutely. John, until next time, thank you again for bringing the alpha and omega of product development to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Thank you for providing me this opportunity, Tom. I'm very grateful.
In Reread Saturday News, we continue the read or reread of The Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni. We seem to be moving from cliffhanger to cliffhanger over the past few weeks, and we shall do so again today. Lencioni uses crises to illustrate common problems that make teams into dysfunctional collections of individuals. This week, we tackle the sections from Entering the Danger to Rebound. Visit the Software Process and Measurement blog to participate in this and previous rereads. Link in the show notes, www.tkagley.wordpress.com. The next Software Process and Measurement Cast, 416, will feature our interview with Kirk Botula. Kirk is the CEO of the CMMI Institute. Kirk and I talked about organizational capability and why capability is crucial for organizational health and agility. If process improvement is a never-ending journey, why do so many people ask, when will we arrive? See you next week.